All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.
The Lord of the Rings movies are better than the books.
Soft sci-fi often can just be like, okay, it's fantasy, but with guns.
I hate Sanderlanches. Every plot line gets delayed until the end, and the storytelling does not have natural progression. Am I moving the stick a lot?
A little bit.
I'm sorry.
I put the prop down.
can I just please hold the stick?
No.
God, it's so fun.
It's distracting.
Okay. Hello, welcome back to another To The Ramble episode. I'm one of your hosts, Austin.
I'm your other host, Richard.
Rich and I today are doing a little bit of funsies. If you can see here, we have a stick, a really well-made stick that says agree or disagree with your book hot takes. You all submitted hot takes, and specifically what we mean is you, as in our patrons on our Discord, our book club. We put this question out of what are your book hot takes, non-spoilers, so we will not be spoiling any books. We asked, hey, what are some hot takes? Then we'll go ask our social media, like our Instagram and YouTube community. They sent us so many hot takes, we're just taking the patron submissions because
that is their privilege and their curse.
They were relentless. They had so many hot takes, and so much of the fact is this is likely going to be a two-parter. We ramble. We're not going to get to all of them.
Yeah, you're right.
But we will try to get, the goal is let's get 12 hot takes covered today.
Okay.
Do you think we could do that?
I don't know. We thought we were going to go through 5 comments. Yeah. We got through 1.
It's forever a stain on us. Yes.
Yeah.
That was great, though.
That was one of my favorite episodes recorded in a long time.
It is my favorite. I love it.
It was so much fun.
Do you want to give some insight into how you made these beautiful sticks, Rich? Look at these. Look at that stick.
I cut the stick.
Yep.
I put it on cardboard with tape.
Great job, buddy. You did great. Look at that.
Yay.
Okay.
You know, this is why we work well together. You were so easily pleased. It helps.
It's a great stick. And look how low effort this is. If anybody can see the abomination of tape that you've just plastered over here, it's beautiful.
I made
beautiful.
His first. Yeah. And I learned, and I did mine second.
Yours looks so much better. Yep. I'm very...
You're easily pleased. I'm happy.
Yes. All right, we will see.
The first one.
The first hot take here is from Zier. Thank you, Zier. Here's what he says. It's better to read one book over the span of a year where you thoroughly enjoy, dissect, and digest it rather than to read 10 books a month to meet superficial reading goals. All right. You know what? Just out of principle... You're going to agree?
Yeah.
Because the way he worded
it's the last part of that sentence of if you're just trying to hit reading goals, like, yeah. We have the same problem with a friend of ours who likes to go to foreign locations. He likes to go to foreign travel, not to like see interesting things around the world. It's just to mark it off of his map of
I
have been here. He is completely satisfied of going to the airport, peeking his head out and going, I have now been to this country. Let us leave. That's the same thing with books is what I'm hearing. It's like people who want to just, like, I got to read 10 books this month. It's like, well, why? Did you absorb any of it? Like, did you have fun? At least it sounds more like a chore than an actual hobby.
So you disagree with this, or you agree with this hot take of he's correct, Azir is correct. You should read one book over the span of a year, you thoroughly enjoy, dissect it, rather than the 10 a month for superficial reading goal.
The reason why I disagree, like all that caveat would be where I agree. It's like, you read one book a year? No. Like, I'm betting the person who read 10 books a month probably, even though they didn't gain as much from each book,
yeah,
are doing better than the person who read one book that entire year.
Now, we're not putting it in the middle and saying neutral. We're deciding on agree or disagree.
Yeah, because neutrality is the position of cowards.
Exactly. And look, we're not doing that cut forward to me going neutral on like half of these. But for right now,
I hate fence sitters. Pick a side.
Hey, this does look like a fence post. So maybe, did you do that purposefully or was it just stick?
No, it's a stick.
Okay.
It holds the paper.
Great. Great job again. I love it so much. If you're audio only, you're missing out. It's a great stick. So I was going to go, hey, neutral, because the way he worded each part here, Zero, you were very tricky with this. So I can't defend and go, yeah, it's good to hit your superficial reading goal. No.
Thing is, but how much we've been talking about how we need to up our reading goals a month. Like, we're reading too few books. Mm-hmm.
The reason I disagree for myself, because here's what I could see. Reading as a hobby, for me, even if you're, reading one book, let's use his example here of reading one book over the span of a year or 10 books a month. So he's saying essentially 120 books a year. He's saying it's better to read one book a year that you thoroughly understand than 120 books to superficially hit. I will specifically disagree with this because I bet if I superficially read 120 books, there would be two that I at least liked and enjoyed more than just the enjoyment I got out of one.
I would agree.
The spread he gives, even if you're being weird and just wanting to get the book done, you're going to get more than one that you love that much. And
I agree.
There is
also, you're reading that much. So I do think it's not a... this is not a vacuum. Like, if you are reading that fast, like, there is a stage where, like, you're not really comprehending it, get it?
Yep.
But the faster you read, generally you improve. You improve the rate at which you understand things, and you actually can comprehend a lot more, a lot quicker. Like, that is, it's like a muscle. You can train it. Mm-hmm. So maybe in the beginning of the year, you're not comprehending as many, but probably at a certain point you are starting to grab more. Like, you'll probably be better at it by the end of the year.
Yes.
So,
and the problem with this, where it puts us into agree or disagree, the correct answer is read more than one and do what you're able to comprehend is the correct answer without just reading blindly.
Always try and read a little bit more than what you can.
Push yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah. And hey, if it starts to not become a hobby and you go, wow, this feels like work and chore, then reevaluate. Yeah. Slow down.
Or, you know, be a YouTuber and like it actually is your job.
And then it matters to some degree.
Yeah.
See that? Hey, maybe let us know if you agree or disagree with what our reaction to these. But that's just the first one. You want to go on to number two?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you very much to Display for sponsoring this video. Display is the premium metal posters you put onto your wall with magnets. Come check it out. Zoom in here. Goes on simple. Punch it back. No. Display, not me.
Okay.
Display, metal posters. You put a protective leaf, magnet on the wall, slap it on there. Makes it great because you can actually swap them out. Bam. You can keep them crooked. Look at that. Avant-garde.
Wow. What does Austin think?
Well, let's see what Austin has to say. Where does he keep his display?
Thanks for asking, Rich. This is where I keep my display of Wave Kings. And we've also got some other cool ones like the Balrog from Lord of the Rings. And, of course, a frog, a toad. Playing a ukulele of some sort. But yes, if you want to check out Displates to get stuff like this to put in your office, home, wherever you want, use code TUTORAMBLE, TTORAMBLE, at checkout for up to 30% off. And we'll get right back to the hot takes episode.
Number two is from Gecko. Name there is now Bibble Defender. Bibble. So Gecko says...
Too many name changes. It hurts my brain.
Gecko says... More straight men should read romance, both romanticy and contemporary, because not only might they learn a thing or two, there's a lot of great books to be found, and you shouldn't miss out on great literature just because it's geared towards a demographic you're not a part of. What do you think, Rich?
Before I read Pride and Prejudice, it would have been a disagree.
It would have been.
Because ultimately, like, the romance books we were reading were like, I don't know if that's particularly helpful for straight men. Don't know if those are like, maybe it is. Maybe it's something of like, hey, if this book is geared toward straight women, then hey, men, you should know what ladies are looking for. At least maybe you don't actually emulate this stuff, but maybe know what is desired or entertaining in some sense. Like, it's knowledge, but it's not fun. It's chore. It's
you don't
it's not
enjoy
for you.
It.
Who cares? Like, I don't know if you should read it. Then read Pride and Prejudice. I'm like, yeah, you should. it's great literature. I think you'll learn something from it. And you can, if you pick the good ones, then you don't need to read the trash ones.
Well, I know Gecko also doesn't like ACOTAR and ACOMAF.
Then yeah, so, we're probably in the same. Agree.
I'm saying agree more so. What Gecko worded it differently than other people did, because other people, we got a lot of hot takes on here where I was a little disappointed some patrons, because a lot of the hot takes were, hey, it's generally good to read. Oh, like, yeah, what a hot take. You know,
you told me one of them.
Yeah.
I'm disappointed. I want you to find that person so we could publicly shame
them. We'll let them know. We'll let them know, of course.
Publicly, though?
Just make a specific video on them?
No, just in the video, call them out for being generic and not hot taking.
I'll have to, maybe for part two, you have to remind me between takes. Okay. But a lot of people, they said, hey, it's generally good to go read outside your genre. And if I just give you that, of course you'll agree. This is more specific about, hey, something that's directly not geared toward you. And what should you read something that's directly not geared toward you? Is that good? And the way Gecko's wording it is saying you shouldn't miss out on great literature. So you would describe Pride and Prejudice as great literature.
Yeah.
But other romance and stuff that's just not for you, you would not define that as great literature.
Not as much, no.
Yeah.
It could still be entertaining. It could still be worthwhile, but it wasn't worthwhile to me particularly. So
yeah, I would specifically say I agree for myself, mainly because Rich and I are at the point where we're reading enough to where it is good to go outside your genre a bit to understand things. Your genre takes inspiration from other genres. If you're trying to write a story, it's good to learn how our story is told in other mediums, etc. But I would say for a person or a reader that reads 2 books a year, 3 books a year. Am I moving the stick a lot?
A little bit.
I'm sorry.
I put the prop down.
can I just please hold the stick?
No.
God, it's so fun.
It's distracting.
Okay. So, when an Italian holds a stick. So, for the person that reads 2 to 5 books a year, for them, I'd say don't go outside your genre. The things that you like, because what you're trying to do then is get into the habit of reading, or you want to read stuff you enjoy. Mm-hmm. For a veteran reader, which we're maybe barely at that veteran phase, but to be honest, compared to the population we are, compared to people watching this on BookTube, much less so. Mm-hmm. But you walk on the street, people aren't reading even 10 books a year. So for those people, I would probably more lean disagree, because it's their obligation. They're only reading so much. Read something you like, you know?
But to Gecko's point here, like, he's specifically targeting of, like, straight men should read, like, romance more. Like, mainly for the purpose of, like, straight men reading romance books that are targeted for straight women. Is there value in that? Personally, I do think so. Like, straight men tend to not understand what women are attracted to. I think vice versa, too. Like, both men and women often fail to understand. Like, there are universal things that men and women both want in each other as a partner. And then there's other little things that men go, wait, really, you value that? Women go, wait, really, you value that? Like, I don't get it. And it's just difference of perspectives and often culture. But yeah, no, I think it's generally valuable. Little tip, be exciting, but don't be toxic. The reason why you see a bunch of like red pill men going like, women only want toxic men. No, it's not true. They want exciting men. Exciting people are emotional roller coasters. Like, they're a little bit fun. It just so happens to be toxic people are also emotional roller coasters. Like, it's unfortunate, but can you be exciting and have like an emotional highs and lows while not being an ass? That is the secret. Anyway, that's what I learned from Pride and Prejudice and Fourth Wing. And ACOTAR. So
I learned you were sorry. Yeah. I heard half of that because the stick is really distracting. I really got to stop myself. I'm going to set it here so you get the control when I touch stick. Okay. Actually, no, please. No, please. I almost gave away the cocaine and I had to pull back. Yes. So I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
And on top of that, I guess, only caveat is if somebody came to me and I'm trying to get them to become, I'm talking new reader.
Reader?
I'm talking someone that doesn't read much a year and they're going, hey, I want to get into reading. And let's say reverse roles. And I know it's, you know, Nicole or somebody and going, hey, want to be a reader. I know they're not going to want a testosterone boost Just for the Boys book.
Yeah.
And hey, you get to read three books a year. Why don't you put Red Rising, Rage of Dragons, and Marcus Aurelius's Meditations on your list?
Actually, that one, yes, it's short. You should read it. That's universe for everybody. But your other point stands.
Again.
It still
again,
stands.
The only point is, yes, this is...
Put the stick down.
The only thing I'm saying is this is great advice for readers.
Yes.
For people that,
yes.
Yeah. That's it. Gatko, great discussion. Good. Point. See? This is great. Okay, that was the second one. Third one. We talk, then stick. Third one's from Levy. Levy, he's got a lot of hot takes.
He is our hot take man in our Patreon. He is notorious for the man that doesn't like books.
He submitted maybe 20 hot takes.
We kid.
Yeah, we kid. We kid. He submitted maybe 20 hot takes or so. And of course, I'm using a couple, but I have to be sparingly.
Did you just search in our Discord all of his comments and just take everything?
No, he submitted
everything
them.
He says.
No, he submitted. Oh, okay. He submitted a list, a bullet point list, a thesis statement of hot takes.
Wonderful.
A couple people that Paige did too. Nick did too, our editor. So we got several good ones coming up. Okay. Levy's hot take, one of his hot takes is, a lot of grimdark stories mistake excessive violence, cruelty, and cynicism for depth. True darkness in storytelling comes from emotional weight, not just throwing in suffering for shock value.
Yeah, completely agree.
It's a hard agree. Hard agree, Levy.
Hard agree.
Good take, Levy.
Good nuanced take. Yes. That was often my problem with, and this is a mistaken view, but it was what I envisioned it, why I never got into the Game of Thrones TV show when it was in its prime and everything. Mm-hmm. Is that's what I thought it was. I thought it just on trailers and how people were talking about it, because people don't, around the office, around school, no one talks about the emotional depth that Game of Thrones actually had. It was all about the shock value of that guy surprisingly died and it's so grim. Like, the how they talked about it just sounded like just gratuitous violence and shock value gore.
Oh,
and
it
that
wasn't.
Was all it is. I was wrong, but that's what I thought it was. And yeah, there's other books like that as well.
I have a hot take. There's a show that I think does this, and I know it's not completely at fault, but it gives me the vibe. It's the first thing I thought of. Invincible.
Oh, yeah, 100%, yes.
Oh, you agree with me? You agree with my hot take?
I completely agree with
really?
You. Oh, yeah, no. The amount of, like...
I thought I would get pushback from you in the commenters on that.
No.
Okay.
You will get pushback in the comments.
Because
I know Invincible is well-loved.
It's well-loved. We haven't really talked... We have not talked about Invincible, so...
No. Thing is, I understand what the comments are going to try and say of it. It straddles the line between an actual satire and taking the genre seriously. It deals with emotional things. Like, there are some elements in it, but I have read the comic, but the show, especially season one.
I've just seen season one. That's my knowledge of it.
I don't think it's deep. I think it's mainly just gratuitous violence, and that's about it. I think it's generally pretty boring.
You agree with my hot take? Wow. You're going to have to throw in a hot take here that I agree with you later. It can come up naturally.
I'll find it.
Yeah.
We'll agree on something. Something also is the same thing is The Boys.
Oh.
For the most part, I think it is just gratuitous violence and shock value.
You know?
Especially past season one. Season one, I thought it had that shock value, but there was maybe something.
To clarify for audience, we're not going to spoil shows either. We're just talking about the general thing. There's violence in these shows.
Yeah.
Just want to be clear, because some people will be bothered. So
sure.
No spoilers, yeah.
But that's generally my thought on the rest of the show. All of the rest of the themes are not really dark. It does have political messaging, but it's just kind of cynical, yeah.
So I think, did we watch season one and two together, right? Mm-hmm. So I remember, I really enjoyed season one. That was a killer season of television.
Then there was also an awesome scene in season two.
Oh, yes, which everyone knows the scene.
Whole thing worth it.
It was such a good scene.
But the rest of the season,
Homelander is one of the greatest, he's stunning. So, not greatest people, greatest just actors and characters. It really, a villain's villain.
In comparison to all this,
yeah,
you haven't read it, but Mm-hmm. And maybe one day I'll actually get you to read it and we'll talk about it, but not actually make a video on it because this is not a manga channel. But Berserk, that is grimdark. And it has its gratuitous violence and like just balls to the wall, like the most vile, vicious shit you've ever seen. But also it's mostly about the emotional depth and trauma that he goes through. That's what really makes it grimdark. So one of the better examples.
It is a good comparison here of what Levy's getting at. What we're getting at is this excessive violence with no depth is the same thing as having titillating content of just smut or sexualized content just for the sake of arousing the viewer, which again, that's a separate genre. I mean, there's your 50 Shades of Grey. There's stuff that, hey, I want to be aroused. I want this thing. But when you could try to say that your provocativeness has depth to it, but really it's just there for the entertainment value. Mm-hmm. And you try to enshroud it with you're going for something deeper, that's the problem. Because, hey, if you want to lean into that, lean into that. Yep. But if you're trying to say, oh, there's a reason, you're justifying your porn. Like, hey, some of my favorite movies that came out this year, like Poor Things, there's a bunch of porn and Poor Things. It's also a phenomenal film to me, but I get it when people say excessive nudity. That's a fair criticism. Mm-hmm. And The Substance that came in my top three films of this year, or technically last year, 2024.
Poor Things, Emilio Perez.
No. That movie sucks. He knew that would get me. But for the sake of that, it's, hey, that is definitely a thing you can serve your audience. Mm-hmm. But wear it on your sleeve. Don't try to say, oh, there's really deep meaning to this when you do. Which, again, I would say there's some films in that where there is deep meaning to it. Game of Thrones being one. I would even say The Boys, why it didn't feel too excessive to me is it was, I guess I liked it. And there wasn't, I guess, a deep message I got out of it. But I didn't think The Boys was also going hard in the paint of like, oh, look. It's about...
It's mostly just satire in the genre. That's all it is.
Which is... Oh, my God. I'm finding out so much about myself right now. Having the stick down, I'm able to actually think.
Yeah.
maybe this is part of my problem with movies, and I've said this before, like Joker and others, where it's just that the excessive depression, the excessive trauma porn-type movie... which people do love. Some people love that to me isn't that deep, but then people leave the movie theater going like, oh my God, look at it was just what you see, what you get for it. For me, it's just not that deep. That I guess that's part of it. Why I get frustrated with some of those movies and those kind of books. When the author is trying to say, hey, look, I'm going for something more here, but really it's, seems very surface level. If it's surface level and it doesn't seem like they're trying to preach to you a deeper meaning, then I'm like, oh, good. You're leaning into it. Cool vibes. That's my take. I'm going to hold a stick so I talk less.
Put it down. It was much better when distraction.
You know how people hold a stick so that they like get to talk? I'll do that to stop. And then I'll set it down later.
Just put it down.
All right.
What's the next one?
Oh, you had no thoughts on that? You're just...
I completely agree with you.
Okay.
It's the exact same thing of, you know, the trauma porn of just like, oh, yeah, they suffer, and then, like, that's why, you know, society. Like, yeah, get over yourself. It's the common trope of, oh, the reason why they're making society suffer is because society, like, persecuted them. And I'm like, no, that's not a deep message. It's just stupid, and no one should really take that for a good moral lesson, or even the opposite of like, oh, it's actually a lesson not to. Well, duh. Like, it's not worth your time. So the same thing with Joker. There was, I remember vaguely, like, what was it? Falcon and the Winter Soldier type stuff where the terrorist organization was like, oh, but we're being oppressed, so that's why we're bombing this hospital. And then the new Captain Americas are like, hey, we shouldn't like be super mean to the terrorists. They got a point. It's like, but they blew up a hospital.
I said no spoilers to people, but I guess that's like,
I don't care about spoiling that show. Who gives a shit?
Just little warnings. Maybe Nick put a disclaimer for people.
No, gotta be, they don't deserve
some,
it.
Some people.
The show doesn't deserve a spoiler warning. There are some that
clarify.
Don't.
When I say no spoilers, I mean I won't spoil. I'm going to have to start having you say that, so you have to commit to not spoiling. But also, I think from that show, I think that is what happens, right?
Yeah.
I can't even remember it.
I'm being hyperbolic, but I'm not like completely wrong. So anyway.
Dang.
Anyway.
Okay. So that
next one.
Levy, another great hot take that got us going deep. Okay. The next one. I can hold. Okay. Getting ready.
You get to hold the stick. This is a
double whammy. Okay. This is another Levy take.
Okay.
Double whammy for Levy. He says, people act like hard sci-fi is somehow superior to space operas or soft sci-fi, but at the end of the day, it's still full of speculation, speculative, often impossible ideas. The difference is that it just hides them under more math.
Ooh.
Want me to say it once more?
Yeah. Okay. One more time.
I did butcher a little bit. Here's his take. People act like hard sci-fi is somehow superior to space operas or soft sci-fi, but at the end of the day, it's still full of speculative, often impossible ideas. The difference is, it just hides them under more math. You know what?
Disagree.
You know what? We got to disagree somewhere, so I'll agree. I was on the edge. I'll agree just so we disagree.
Yeah,
we got to be fun with it. Okay. Why do you disagree?
I guess it's the overall. I understand the point of if you have a very soft sci-fi world, but you do enough to, you know, explore very interesting theme, interesting speculation, like, sure, it can work. However, there's a lot of hard sci-fi that does, like, just generally does that better. And it's just attention to detail. Like, are you really going to say, like, Star Wars is as thematically deep or interesting compared to, I don't know, Werner Vinge Upon the Deep.
Fire Upon the Deep?
Fire Upon the Deep. No, it isn't. It just isn't. Most space opera is Flash Gordon, but with extra steps. And I love Flash Gordon.
Also, Fire Upon the Deep is a space opera.
A hard sci-fi space opera, if you want to point out.
It's like both
the hard
those,
versus soft. Like, Star Wars
defines a hard sci-fi?
I think you get harder sci-fi when you actually get into real mathematical theories, and the closer you are to real science or real scientific theories, I think the closer you are to that. Like, basically, the difference between, how does this cryo sleep work? And you go through the like intricate details of, actually it freezes the body under this certain temperature, but the fluids need to be externally stored and all that, like, going into the finer details of it and giving hypotheticals on how this actually functioned. And then the soft sci-fi being grav boots. They make you go.
I knew you were thinking Red Rising when this first came up.
Yeah.
Well, Levy also hates Red Rising, by the way. So he's on your side with that.
I like Red Rising. I just feel like I have to be the negative Red Rising guy.
We have to lean into our disagreements where they are. Because we're more alike than we think, so we just have to double down when it comes down to it.
But no, the thing is, Red Rising does other things that make it very valuable. Sci-fi, mostly in terms of societal hierarchical structures.
Yes, again, keeping spoiler-free. No more spoilers. I know.
That's not a spoiler.
No, the winner, the Captain America whatever thing came up, and I just want to clarify, no book spoilers. We're not doing that.
All right.
Just be very careful.
Unless the book sucks, then I don't mind spoiling
it. But you can't do that. No. Okay.
Fine.
Disagree. Okay. Sorry, continue.
Oh, that was it. I think hard sci-fi is generally better.
Got it. It is better, and also saying at the end of the day, it's more deep, here's the stake. It's the people act like hard sci-fi, it's superior. So this is why it appeals to you, because it is superior to you.
Yes.
Interesting. So here's why I agree with you, Levy. And I'm probably, I don't know if I'm taking this direction of what he's thinking when he's posing the question, but I think there's hard sci-fis I can think of and soft sci-fis that both leave me a thought-provoking message. And what I mean by, maybe this is even comparing fantasy versus sci-fi. Typically, sci-fi has this idea of it's more intellectual, which your Fire Upon's Deep, your Children of Times, your Dunes, right? There's an obvious example, Hyperion, so you could think of like that. But I don't think it's also fair to compare like a fantasy or a soft sci-fi message about morality or man versus, you know, when you get that microscope versus, okay, yes, Ken Liu, not Ken Liu specifically, the three-body problem talks about the Fermi's paradox, which is just an intense and wow, that what a thing that I don't know enough about. Or Werner Vinge talks about like the singularity. So that is as valuable as a soft sci-fi exploring something as simple as leadership. And I don't mean that in Red Rising is more hard, like deep than Werner Vinge's is, but there are just as valuable messages from your not hard sci-fi or just as intelligent ways to go about it. Where I think Sun Eater does with Christopher Rocchio, his isn't even necessarily, like it gets into it later in the series.
It's not sci-fi.
It doesn't describe how the stuff, which not spoiling, doesn't describe how the stuff works up to the point we're at, right? Doesn't give you like details. However, the book's messages so far have centered around things that aren't necessarily Fermi's paradox. So I don't even want to say it because I want people to read on their own for it. But you see what I mean in someone like Rocchio, who does, it's not soft, it's not hard. It's a space opera.
I do think just the further you go into it, the hard sci-fi is generally, in my opinion, a superior use of the genre. Of a soft
sci-fi. Oh, you're going C.S. Lewis on this?
Yeah. Soft sci-fi often can just be like, okay, it's fantasy, but with guns.
Mm.
Like, could this story have been told a different way? Yeah. And does it use the genre of sci-fi to its maximum? I don't think so. Part of the idea of a hard sci-fi is you take a theoretical concept today or whatever era it is and push it forward. And like, hey, look at this weird technology that we don't completely understand, or take this weird mathematical concept we don't particularly understand, but we're learning more about it. What would it be like in 500 years, in 30 years? Like, what I love about Andy Weir is it's hard sci-fi, but it's like 15 years in the future hard sci-fi. It's really fun speculative. It's relevant. That I find is it's just a superior use of the genre in general. There are, of course, exceptions, but if you just have like soft sci-fi, Flash Gordon, like that's kind of what I think of a bunch of them.
No shade to these. Here's where I agree with you. No shade to a book like Jade City. But I feel that exactly what you mean of it feels like the genre is just an attachment to where you could get the same story in a different setting, essentially.
Yeah.
And perspective. So for me, Jade City, it takes place in that mafioso gangster. And I only read book one for this. I know I've heard it gets better. But to me, you just take away the fantasy element of it. And it's like, oh, I've seen this story before.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of thing that you're talking about.
Yeah,
that's what you're getting at, right?
Yeah, basically.
Yeah. I think with the soft, like, what do you think about something like Murderbot or All Systems Red? Would you consider that soft sci-fi, hard, not space opera definitely, but that softer sci-fi maybe?
It's mostly softer sci-fi. However, I will say, I think where it gets closer to hard sci-fi, what is the focus of that story? Its focus is on the merging of human and machine and what makes up humanity. In a like technological like
and also some red and yeah, Murderbot. Yeah.
It's the merging of man and machine and where does your humanity come from and your experience that way. I think that is a very hard sci-fi topic that like kind of has to be done in that genre.
Well, see,
so it's a more useful term.
I also think you might be conflating the term hard sci-fi with superior. Like when you think high, when you think high concept, you think hard sci-fi.
Yeah.
Maybe you just think the two are one. You know what I mean? Because to me, like All Systems Red and that isn't, I guess when I'm thinking hard sci-fi, it's like, oh, they're going into the numbers. Like this functions like this exactly. That's how it works.
That's a fair point.
You know what I mean?
Murderbot is more soft sci-fi.
So when I'm thinking, it's just a focus point of, I guess why using those other examples with three body problem, all this vertebrae again, all those, So all those are focusing on, when I think of those books, I also think way less character focused. They are going for something different. And when you pick out something, All Systems Red or Sun Eater, which are on less hard sci-fi than the other ones mentioned, are more character focused and thematically matters to the characters rather than the concept. A sci-fi writer that's going hard sci-fi sometimes goes, if they prioritize concept over character or insert whatever there, it doesn't have to be that. Sometimes that, both are valuable.
Is why I think Andy Weir is one of the masters of sci-fi.
He does both? Yeah.
Oh no, he does both to perfection. That's like awesome. It is about a hard scientific concept where you're like, oh wow, really thinking about that nature. I'm not spoiling anything, but hard concept for sci-fi, but also the characters are well focused and it's a discovery for their character. The characters are interesting on their own.
That's amazing.
It's everything you want.
Yes. Just a quick definition says subgenre that emphasizes scientific accuracy and logic. So yeah, basically they know what they're talking about. They get into the weeds of things.
It's kind of same thing of Mark Lawrence's Book of the Ancestor series is a fantasy series.
Yes.
Yet it has hard sci-fi world building and it's awesome. Because he knows what he's talking about. He's a physicist. He got PhD. He's a smarty pants.
Okay.
And it shows.
I think we covered that one.
Yeah.
You ready for the next one?
Let's go to the next one.
This one's by our guy, Jai Sedai. Oh, wow. Jai Sedai. Let's go.
I like this guy. He likes Wheel of Time. His take can't be that hot.
I don't like this guy. Hi, Jai. So here's his hot take. Ooh, very curious. And again, no spoilers, please, because you'll hear this word and want to spoil things. Jai Sedai says, I hate Sanderlanches. Every plot line gets delayed until the end, and the storytelling does not have natural progression. I will go here. You also disagree.
I will have to hold to my opinion of just because I don't like book five doesn't mean books 1 through 3, their Sanderlanches don't slap. They're so good. So, yeah. Why do you disagree with that?
That was the same thing that came to my head. I can't let the stubbornness of book five just be like, So I disagree because the juice is worth the squeeze for those books where it sticks in my memory so well and is such a cathartic avalanche of emotions. And the more legs a book has and the more it runs in my mind after reading it, that's a good sign that you read an incredible book. And that happens when a Sanderlanche hits. It does that for life. I will always remember the lines and the moment and that emotion it brought. Yeah, I forget a lot of it. But then again, name another story, just call it out next time I'm doing that. It's not purposeful. I have a problem. Okay. Wow. So
we're just going to
hand it to me.
Hand it to you on the next one.
That's best. Can I bring that home, please? But that is what I'm getting at, where what Jai says here, if the storytelling does not have natural progression. I think it does have natural progression, definitely. But also, I understand where the risk. Point... Yeah, I understand the point's coming from. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, no. The definition between a slow burn and just a boring book is the juice worth the squeeze? Ultimately, you're playing that risk. If the Sanderlanche is not hitting or too much development and setup is done at the end where everything is ramped up, where you go, wait, why did I spend 800 pages for all of the stuff to get wrapped up in here and all set up and delivered at the end? That's where it gets frustrating. Where did this come from? It came right at the end. Why didn't you set this up in the 800 pages you had before? So I get that. But if it hits, it hits. So it's normally worth it. Now, those are individual books. Can a series, because Sanderson, if you're looking at Stormlight as a series and the fifth book is the Sanderlanch of Stormlight. Now you go back and go, was the juice worth the squeeze?
That's where you go into, and again, no spoilers, but Mistborn, that and the first era in that trilogy, there's, again, Sanderlanch at the end of book three, Hero of Ages, that puts everything in full picture, goes, wow, everything from book one
made sense.
Made sense. He set this up perfectly.
It was necessary. It wasn't set up at the end and delivered.
Yes.
It was set up from the beginning and slowly laid out.
Yes. Yes. So again, everyone knows our takes with Wind and Truth. It's, I think Sanderson at this point must have heard about it. No. That was a bit too much. I'm getting a little bit
That's a little arrogant.
I'm getting cocky with like the stick. I just want it. It's just, I'm getting really, really cocky with this. I'm just feeling like on edge today. So that's where we stand with the Sanderlanches?
Yeah. Okay. I still like them when it works.
Cool. All right. Next one?
Yep.
Like Thor's hammer. Like Thor's hammer. Yes. Okay. This one. Here we go. This is from Udi. You ready for this one?
Alrighty.
Okay. This is what he says. The best SFF literature of each decade is an improvement on the decade previous because they had the previous works to build on. Note, the average work of every decade is not necessarily better than the best or average of previous decades because quality can swing a lot. But the best is always an upward trajectory. For this reason, whether you like or dislike Lord of the Rings, it is clear to me that Lord of the Rings walked so that later authors could run and so modern authors could fly.
Disagree.
Also disagree.
I think it goes on the assumption that history is always in a progressively positive direction. And I don't think that with history or art or anything. It's just because things are changing over time doesn't mean it's good change. It's just change. We have dark ages for a reason. We look at Lord of the Rings of, yeah, Lord of the Rings ran so others could walk. I think a lot of books lean on the previous generations, and honestly, they get away with a lot more crap because people have the imagery of Lord of the Rings. The fact that Lord of the Rings built up elves, dwarves, the Ents, like the entire fantasy landscape, then another book comes out and they don't really have to describe elves anymore. The reading Orconomics, which is a, you know, loosely based D&D satire kind of thing, it leans heavily on, like, you don't need to explain to the audience of what an elf is. You don't need to explain to the audience what an orc is or a goblin. Like, you get it because Lord of the Rings. And I don't know if that's like, oh, that's better now. Like, all of a sudden. No.
Udi would say that because you have that previous quality, that the best, basically the best of each following decade, the best work made there is better than the previous because it has more information, more stuff to go off of. I completely agree with what you said, that just because time moves forward doesn't mean that quality moves forward.
Yeah.
The term Renaissance is called Renaissance, a resurgence, for a reason.
Yeah. Things got bad and then they got better. But then they got worse again. Like that's it's not all a straight line.
Yeah. And onto that, too, a part of it is when, because I think Udi, for example, thinks A Song of Ice and Fire better than Lord of the Rings. We haven't read A Song of Ice and Fire yet. But that take of looking at Lord of the Rings and reading it in the modern, reading as a modern reader, leading Lord of the Rings and not liking it as much, could be also just reader's preference. You could think Lord of the Rings is a one star. And you just like modern books. And because you grew up in modern culture, are led to like certain types of books as well. So just the time you're living could also change your perspective of what quality literature is. Because we can't look back at Beowulf and legitimately say, wow, best book I've ever read. Or the Iliad, best book I've ever read. Because I don't even understand the language it was written in. Some things are lost through translation. And to me, to go and judge a book that long ago that was written for a different people, how can that quality to this quality even be compared? You know, it at a certain rate, yeah. It's like that was just a different person was being told this story. I don't even today, if a book comes out in a different language and Translations are great, don't get me wrong. And that's why you should also watch things that are subbed, not dubbed. Always subbed.
Two exceptions.
Yes.
Cowboy Bebop, Full Metal Alchemist Brotherhood.
Did we dubbed watch is Full acceptable. Oh, yeah, we did watch dubbed with Full Metal.
Dubbed is acceptable is in those two cases. Everything else subbed.
Correct. But I completely agree with what you said, too. How society changes over time. But it's just tough to even look back and have the same idea of how to judge the quality back then. Because we're a critic of modern books.
Yeah.
We go, okay, this is, we've read a lot of modern books we can compare. We read Pride and Prejudice recently. How many books did we read that came out in the early 1800s?
Yeah.
One.
Not one.
Well, maybe Huckleberry. I don't know when other stuff came out.
I think I've read a couple other things.
Mark Twain's way later, I think. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Other things, but.
Yeah. But also there is the factor of language.
Yeah.
Of, because our vocabulary is different. Like, English today is very different from 1800s. Very different from, you know, 1600s. Like, you keep going back. Yeah. It's going to be different. Even if you get a good translation, it's using words that you're not used to. Even Lord of the Rings, which is not that, it's not that old, mm-hmm. uses language that people are not used to today, and it throws people off. Where is that a fair, like, judge of quality of, oh, this uses words that are not as often used today, so I don't connect with it, therefore bad.
Shakespeare.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a lot of vowels in here. Ugh.
Yeah, so I think a lot of it is due to that. If you improve your vocabulary, you can, I think, appreciate those works more.
Oh, yeah.
And you'll probably find, like, actually there's some real bangers in the past that are better than a lot of things today.
That's why we disagree.
That's why we disagree.
That's why we're always right. Except we just disagree on one of these takes so far, so you were wrong once. But I'm keeping track. Yeah. Okay. Mm. So this next one is from Paige. Thank you, Paige, for the submission. And also, thank you. All these people are patrons, so thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Paige, she says, audiobooks are consuming books, but you did not actually read words to read the book. You may count it towards your book goal, but you didn't read it. Disagree. Did you ever agree?
No, I rotated it wrong.
Oh, okay.
I disagree.
I also disagree. Take it away again. Do you want me to? No, not the stick away. I meant take like the answer away. Damn it. My stupid words. Do you want me to take it or are you first?
Hey, you go ahead.
So, and she's technically saying you can still count to your book goal, but she's focusing on the word read here. And this was a video we had where we talked about, do audiobooks count? Now, I would use the analogy here of, are writers even writers? No, they're typers. When's the last?
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.
It's time somebody's physically written a book.
Yeah.
I think it's more a thing of semantics of however you get the words on page or digest the words. The thing that could be, so Paige might be getting at here, is sometimes people listen to an audiobook and aren't actively listening. Mm-hmm. Then you're not completing the book, because a lot of people can think, hey, well, you're doing other stuff, and some people process information differently, that it's, people assume that you didn't actually read the book, because, oh yeah, I could play music in the background too. So if you're actually actively listening to it and digest all the words, you're still doing it. I mean, how would you tell a deaf person they've never read a book before?
Yeah.
A blind person that they've never read a book before.
Well, yeah. Only Braille counts.
Yeah. Right. No, you're not going to do that.
So
that's what I think. So what do you think?
In general, I get it. But also, can you imagine, like, to, you know, steel man the argument?
Yeah.
Your mother is telling you a bedtime story and is reading it to you.
Yeah.
Would you say the child has read that book? No. The mother read the book to the child. The child didn't read the book. The child couldn't really... You get what I mean? Like, almost in no context would you say the child has read the book.
Mm-hmm.
And so you now listening to a book, you are being read a book. Are you reading it? No, someone else is reading it to you. Mm-hmm. How is it different?
I would say for that kid that's 6-7 years old, and also when using the word read here, I'm almost saying the word comprehension. Mm-hmm. Because the parent reads to the kid sometimes a bedtime story to help them fall asleep or sharing the story with them. They're distracted. Is the kid actually digesting that whole book?
What if they do digest the whole book? They completely understand mm-hmm. every word that's being told to them.
Yeah.
Then did they read the book?
I'd say in our everyday language, yes.
What if you handed them the book, mm-hmm. they wouldn't be able to recognize the word on the page? They couldn't read it, but they understand the words when it's told to them.
You make a good point.
And so, they literally couldn't read the book.
Yeah.
But because they were told the book, you could say, oh, yeah, the child read the book.
Yeah, here's what I said. Yeah, you make a good point. When we're using the term read here, when people hear, did you read the book? I think the word has eclipsed its actual meaning. Like when you say search, you Google something. Mm-hmm. Like, does Google mean S-E-A-R-C-H, you search the book? No, it's a different word for using it. You Googled it. So if I went on Bing and looked up something, I searched. I didn't Google though, you know. But you know when a word supersedes. So when people hear the word, yeah.
I have a great counterpoint to my own point.
Oh, did I help you come up with it at least?
You did.
Oh, good. Great.
You reminded me of my mother.
Okay, yes.
My mother and I were talking about reading books and how she used to, she would skim books. Mm-hmm. Book club would come up and she's only halfway done. She would read the last chapter and then go back and skim and skip paragraphs or pages and just kind of skim through the whole mm-hmm. book. And Mom, you didn't read the book then, really. You sort of you spark noted it. I don't know if you've read the book mm-hmm. at that point. And then if you tell me afterward, oh yeah, I read a fourth or a half of it. Then I read the last chapter and then I went back and then I skipped paragraphs and I just kind of caught the dialogue. And when they started explaining a bush, I just kind of skipped that part and I moved on. But I didn't like the book. It's he didn't read it.
Right.
Why read it at that point? Then she made a good counteroffer of a lot of these books were biographies. The point of the book is the book club is discussion of what the person did in their life. In that case, a little bit more acceptable, but still, point still stands. If you skim read a book, have you read the book?
No, you skim read.
Yeah. So if it is about comprehension, active listening does count.
Yeah. I just mean, exactly that. And when the term read and read is being used, I don't think anybody is literally saying when you listen to an audiobook, yes, on the semantics, you are listening in the digestion. You are not looking at pages, which is why the first thing I said as an example was, are writers actually writing? No, they're typing. But nobody mm-hmm. would say they're typers who publish a book.
Yeah.
That's what I mean by when read is superseded that word. Same thing as writer. Again, type. Type and write are two different things, but we say writer.
So in today's colloquial context of read, if you have read something, you have consumed a literature with a high degree of comprehension.
Yes.
And if that is the definition we're running with, audiobooks count. Same thing with Braille. Same thing with being told the story. Vice versa, whatever.
The one exception I would maybe say, and here's where it would be a little different, is a graphic audio that doesn't use all the he said, she says, and is a more dramatized version. That's where I'd say, hey, I listened to the graphic audio. It's different enough to go, you didn't read it in its raw form. Because if you're listening to the book and getting every word that's also on the page, it's just a form of how you're digesting the words.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a different, I would consider graphic audio almost a different type of medium to an extent.
It's the same way someone says tries to say, oh yeah, I read Lord of the Rings when they actually just watched the movies.
Not the same.
It's not the same. Nope. Same thing of graphic audio. Mm-hmm. I get it. To a lesser degree.
Yeah, lesser degree. Because it doesn't fully, but
that's right. Graphic audio doesn't count.
Mm.
Heard it here.
That's what we came to. That conclusion. All right, stick time. Here we go. Paige, you were so good at coming up with a hot take.
Well, read the next one, then I'll hand it to you.
It's also by Paige.
Okay.
Also, we I think we... That solidified my opinion on audiobooks, I think, for you. Because we had the question in the video we did, mm-hmm. but I think here clarified. I think good. I have a stance now.
Yeah.
Right. Paige also says authors. Oh, Paige. Oh, okay. Rich, what do you think? Authors should not follow book reviewers, and if you are besties with an author, I don't trust your review. You automatically have a bias.
Ooh!
What a question! Oh! This is one where I am neutral, but I will force myself to pick a side. I will force a side. I have a lot to say on both sides, but I will...
Ready?
Yep. Go ahead. Fair enough. You agree, I disagree.
Yeah.
That's very... I can see it.
I get it. To me, it makes sense. If a reviewer is besties with an author, how can you particularly judge if... their opinion is tainted now. It's like, yeah, it is. Totally is. No matter how much you say, no matter how much you will try, like, your opinion is biased. And I think it's still fine to listen to them if they give their points, they acknowledge their bias, then there you go. Take it with that caveat. But, yeah, of course it's a biased result.
Yes. There's two parts of that sentence there. That's why it's so in between, because first part is saying that authors shouldn't follow book reviewers, and if your besties with an author, doesn't trust a few. So I think it's authors,
I would disagree with that part.
That part of it is, I think it's good for authors to do to an extent as well. And lots of reasons for that. But the automatically have bias, yes. I think the part I more disagree with, again, I agree and disagree. I'll give it to you first.
I think it's more of a practical matter of authors should actually be following reviewers and hopefully make connections and network so they can reach a wider audience.
Especially indies.
That's the point. Like, do you want your book to be read or not? Mm. It's marketing.
Yeah, obvious reasons. Right.
Just on a basic level, no. Yeah. Authors should be following reviewers, especially if you're an indie author and you're going, hey, these reviewers, I think like the people who follow them have the similar audience to what my book would serve. Like, hey, I think this is a good niche. The same people would like the book. Like, hey, look, maybe that reviewer has your audience that your book would speak to. That's valuable. That's valuable to do. So no, to that one. Disagree. Second part, agree.
Yeah, and this is the thing too, that I think it's more of a statement to reviewers themselves. So she says, I don't trust your reviews if you're besties with an author, which is very fair. We've had struggles now where we've had Rocchio on, talk to him, Joe Abercrombie, Fonda Lee, Ryan Cahill was an amazing guy. We both didn't like his book one. But lovely guy. I didn't like book one of... Actually, all the authors we talked to, there's something I didn't like in their books. And then talking with them goes like, oh, what a good person. They're such a good guy, girl. And
I'm just very thankful with Rocchio. I like the guy a lot. We had a great conversation even after the review. Like, we went out to dinner with him. Mm-hmm. Wonderful talk with him. Becoming a lot more friendly. I'm very happy that I read... three of his books before meeting him. It was already in my top five books ever before even meeting him. So if that helps the bias, like, now going forward, am I biased? Yeah, probably. But I'll try to keep that in mind. I will do my best to account for it, acknowledge it, and do my best to push it aside.
And that's what I mean in the portion where she says, I don't trust your review. That portion where I know plenty of reviewers, specifically in the movie space, and when promotional campaigns are happening, and you get so far in your reviewing career where you're invited to events, the red carpets, and you're pampered, you're given all this, and you look up the reviews for shows and an objectively awful show, and you look at these people who are more figureheads talking about Lord of the Rings like they know what they're talking about. And
that rubbed me the wrong way.
Well, Yes. Yeah. So there's several moments and things you can look at where clearly the reviewer's compromised. Clearly. Yeah. And so I totally get the point of they're too close, they're too besties, they're too in it to have an unbiased perspective where, hey, if you were to go to a friend of yours and ask, what do you think about this book? You're going to get an objective, their subjective take, but it's going to be unbiased because they don't know the people. It's just what they think. It's not influencing anybody. They're not in front of a camera. So I totally get that. But I would say, if to agree with your statement on here, Paige, it's hard to even trust any, like, there's always going to be a bit of distrust for the viewer, even if you're not friends with the author, because the fact you are reviewing something and on camera and letting your opinions known already has this amount of bias of, oh, I'm being perceived by people. Do I want to look likable? Do I want to look not likable? Do I want to be benefit of the doubt? Do I want to watch my words? Do I want to alter what I say? Do I want
the video to do well? So exactly. I won't give a neutral opinion.
Exactly.
I'm going to give either, you know, high praise or damning review because, you know, extremes actually get views.
And I can't tell you how true that is for all of our reviews. There's something where if we're negative on something, we can be perceived as we're hating for views. If we're positive on something, we're praising for views. And these comments are totally fine. Like, people can think what they will. It's but this will happen with any reviewer, of the intent of the reviewer will always come into play based on, oh, you're doing this for views anyways. So what are your actual thoughts and opinions? Yeah. So just to steal my goal the far way of, it's even going to a reviewer in the first place, there's always already going to be an inherent bias there. So when you add a layer of an author, I could see it adds another connection and layer there. However, my small objection, because I do get your point, would just be it's probably a problem with the reviewer you're going to in the first place, rather than it being a problem with them being friends. Because I think if there's genuine ways to, and we like to think we are, so this isn't always the case, call us out whenever, because we like to think that we prioritize honesty and just our actual thoughts here and shooting the shit over being compromised, like with a friendship or this and that. And also, if there were somebody that is offended enough in the first place, and all these authors we talked to who we've had bad book reviews of, good book reviews of, if there's anything like that in the first place, we definitely go about it in a fun, tactful way of, because we don't want to be dicks. I only ever want to do that to you. Never to them.
That is the helpful part of having two of us. Like, all of the negativity can be directed at each other and not the actual author.
And when we have the authors on, it's always like you two ganging up on me. It's perfect. It's like,
it's wonderful.
All things are just off your plate.
I can't wait for us to do a review of, like, do another one author review where I really didn't like their, like, or because we've had that, but where I liked the book less than you. That still hasn't come up yet. I haven't been, you know,
tested yet.
No, I just haven't been, like, on that side that we've been putting you on frequently.
Yes. And I guess this is coming from a place of, I again, totally get it, but we've had a review in front of our author where I gave their book a 1.5 star. Now, obviously, I wasn't going through detail of here's why I didn't like it the whole time, but just giving general thoughts. But yeah,
you just have to look at the individual person themselves of what's their history. What have they done before? To me, when I look at reviewers, or specifically like Rings of Power, when that whole press thing came out and the premiere, Amazon put a whole big event and the premiere, they were on the different sets. They were thrown parties. They were done. They were wined and dined. Like, you saw this whole event take place. And then the reviewer goes like, yeah, it was really great. With, like, I have some criticisms, but it was super awesome. And I'm going, was it really that awesome? Are you really sure? And what bothered me is, like, I've seen now a couple different reviewers where I remember at the time they said it was good. And then 2 years later down the road, it bit on a smaller, smaller section of going, like, well, actually, like, you know, season one was not really that good, but I gave it a positive review because I wanted it to continue. I wanted it to improve. I didn't want it to trash it. And going, why? Why weren't you honest in the first place?
And also part
why
of that.
Why'd you say that?
Also part of that, even they could have connections with the studio or whatever it might be, but also they don't want to get hate on. There's this exciting thing that everybody's going, hey, the new season of the show is coming out from a book adaptation I love. Nobody wants to be the guy that goes out there. I mean, there are some channels like this too, but some channels over aggravate the hate on things.
Oh yeah.
And other channels over aggravate the positivity on things.
Yeah.
So go just trust the reviewer. We're not perfect. So just we value like, hey, this is what we value. We don't always get that right. So, yeah. But that's our intentions and you could believe us or not. And then take it from there. But I guess that's what I had a lot more to say on the fact that, yeah, there's automatically bias, but there's bias with everything.
Sure.
So I don't, yeah.
Depends. It's something to consider, but, yeah. And I do agree of like, you see there like, oh wow, the author and the reviewer are best friends. Mm. Maybe their review is not like completely, it's not unbiased. Maybe you should consider that.
Also, I think we're
like,
just,
in all honesty, try and think of like your book. Mm-hmm. I'll do my best, but I guarantee I'll be honest with you, mm-hmm. but man, like I can imagine, like it would be so hard to like you actually decide to publish the book, and I'm coming on like on YouTube and say like it's actually like a 1-star book. I don't think I could do that as yeah. your friend, like your best friend. Like I can't do. I'm just gonna shut my mouth. You know, like I don't yes. know if it's even possible for me to do.
Yeah, that's a great point. Knowing you though, it's not like you'd go and advertise how much you'd hate it. You just say like, hey, I didn't like it. I'm proud that he wrote a book.
I would emphasize the positives if I had any.
But here's you guys might like this. Hey, I'll disclaimer, I didn't like it. I'd imagine you go about it that way.
I would try, but thing is, like,
yeah,
am I gonna be biased? And should my opinion be taken completely seriously of like, oh yeah, this is a really good review, like unbiased review. No, you shouldn't. Mm-hmm. So
that's also very fair. I mean, I was thinking of it in this way. There's a book that we beta read, one of our best buds. Mm-hmm. I won't say his name or anything, but there's a book we beta read and Rich and I grilled him on it. Like grilled as in giving detailed feedback of why it was a genuinely 1-star book. And
one of the worst books we've ever read.
And we were doing this to improve his writing and give feedback of, hey, this didn't work. We think you have a lot of work to do on this, being fully honest with him because it's helpful to him. But are we then going to go on a podcast and bring this up as an example during a hot take episode? No.
Are we going to name drop? Are we going to say his name is
and the book title?
No,
but that's the thing too of, hey, we have that opinion, but we're not going to go out there maybe with a Patrick Ruffus name of the wind. We don't know the guy. We don't like his book. Fuck that book. You know?
Yeah.
Anyways. So yes. Yes.
Well, yes. You know, this just did of us trying to defend our own position on the internet.
Can I get stick?
Read the next one.
No, I just want to just real quick. I was going to go, that's why, Paige, I'm really right here with you because you're right, but there was a lot to say. It's part disagree, part agree.
Part one, disagree. Part two, basically agree, but, you know, depending on the person.
There's degrees.
Judge them in context.
Yes.
Like, especially, hey, are they friendly? Like, they have talked, they've done a couple interviews or they've talked or something once or twice. Okay, that's one level of friendship,
right?
And then there's like they're having Sunday dinner together all the time. It's like,
yeah,
maybe it's a little different.
Yeah, that's very fair. I think that could be a whole video topic on its own.
Mm.
We basically just did the video,
the incestuous relationship of authors and reviewers.
Oh. I don't like that first word, actually.
That's the point. Oh. It's grabby. Oh, it's TikTok. It's YouTube algorithm. It's
okay. We're doing that. There we go. I like it. I like it. All right. The very next one here, Paige, those were some great submissions. This is from Judgmental. Judgmental, how are you doing? Okay. Here's his.
What you do is you put the sign down.
Got it.
Spin it down here.
Suspenseful.
And then.
Got it. Okay.
Spin it down. You can fiddle with it below the hip.
Don't ever say fiddle and blow your hip ever again in the same sentence.
You can fiddle with your stick below the hip.
you freak. So talking about incestuous and now this. Oh my God. Okay. Judgmental, this is your hot take. He says, The Cosmere was a mistake. It detracts from each individual story, and readers feel urged to buy every Sanderson book ever just so they contextualize who the hell this character is. Oh, this is another one. I have things to say on both sides. Well, we got to go same time so that we're not biased from what each other thinks. Hold on. Mm-hmm. Let me put mine over here and not look what you're going to do. You know, I'll go with this, but I'll say stuff on both sides. 3, 2, 1. You got ready? I see it.
There's one key element. I would have disagreed.
Mm-hmm.
But there is an element, a very important element.
Yes.
Of the last book in the Stormlight Archive.
Which we're not talking spoilers.
Which we're not talking specifically about. Mm-hmm. But it's an incredibly important element to Stormlight, Cosmere, and everything. But you think it's important. But then when you get to the end, it actually could have been removed from the entire series, ultimately making one of the main characters pointless. Could have been written out of the books, the entire series. And ultimately all felt like a setup for the Cosmere. That pisses me off. That pisses me off greatly. Of how much of that goes on, of where entire books feel like, oh, this is not an actual book. It's just a setup for a different series. I wanted this series. Why don't you conclude things for this book and this series? Not set up even more stuff on setup, on setup, on setup. So that's where I lean on, like, you know, I agree. Honestly, I'm on the edge. If done slightly better, I would have disagreed. So
that's very fair. It's
my favorite Sanderson books are the ones with the least amount of extra Cosmere shit.
Emperor Soul, you're thinking of, and what else?
Mistborn Era 1, in all honesty. How great was that? There's some little stuff along the side of like, oh, it goes into the Cosmere, but it's ancillary. It's not the focus. It's, ooh, a fun little teaser. Doesn't take away from the story.
His Stormlight's in comparison to Marvel's Avengers, in a way. We haven't had a crossover like that, but that's the biggest we have so far. Yeah, it's hard because I'm trying to, again, not be biased a little bit about my take on Wind and Truth, just finishing it and having that bad taste in my mouth. What I will say is, specifically what he's saying is Cosmere was a mistake, detracts from each individual story, readers feel urged to buy every Sanderson book ever, da da da. So it is a frustration sometimes when you don't get all the references, but I feel confident Bookborn's take I agree with of Bookborn says when you read one of the books, you don't have to contextualize or have all the information to enjoy it. Mm-hmm. Sanderson does do that where you don't have to read that book. You won't get all the references, but I would compare it to Discworld, where Discworld you can read, jump in the series and read like a book 13, Small Gods. You won't get all the references. I read that as my first Discworld. I was still able to love the story without having to get every character mentioned and stuff that was built up from the 12 books prior, just because that's how Discworld works. When Sanderson's at his best, that's what he does. You know, the story works on its own. When in truth, I'll agree with you, there's issues there. I agree with that. I would say more so, it's going to take me a while to trust and get back into Stormlight 6 and Sanderson stuff, but at the very least you can't deny of fantasy and what Sanderson's done. The Cosmere has been the reason, selfish, the reason the channel and just BookTube and book communities, it's pulled such legs. He's doing something different in fantasy. Yes, Marvel's done it there, but fantasy, what else do you have besides the Cosmere? You don't, at Discworld, again, it's kind of that big world, but he's doing something different in the fantasy world, and other people will probably follow suit. So I just like that it's unique, different. I'll try not to hate too much, even though I agree with everything you still said. So,
fair enough.
Yeah. Well,
a good hot take. Yeah.
Yeah. Next one. This next one's from David. Sup, David Seaworth. Okay. David says, here's one. Here's one of mine. So character quality. Oh, I'm very curious what you think. I was excited to talk about this one. All of these, of course, are equal patrons. I love talking about all of yours.
They're not all equal. They are separate, and also not equal.
Superior, you would say.
Some are superior.
Hard sci-fi superior.
Exactly.
So are some patron. You're just going...
So are some patron members.
David says this.
I'm a firm believer in hierarchy. Just in general.
Doesn't need
to be fair. Doesn't need to be a meritocracy. Just as long as a hierarchy exists. With me in the top.
Yes. So David asked this. He says, character quality should be rated in two different regards. One should be the likability and attachment to the character, and two should be the quality, well realized, how real they are, arcs, and tie into the message, story, morale.
I got mine.
I got my time. 3, 2, 1, go. Oh, me too.
Yep.
I thought you would agree with this one.
No.
You disagree as well.
Well, the main thing of you should judge them, but like, in both ways, or both are important. That's how I was taking it, is both aspects are important to a character, and I would completely disagree that likability is a necessary component to a good character. It doesn't need to be likable. They can be, and it can be great if they are, but you don't have to have a likable character for them to be great.
This is where our rating system, our categories come in, and we have a system, a video explaining our rating systems to the Ramble rating system, explain things like episode 124 or 6, something like that. He's saying they should be rated in these two different regards. You know how StoryGraph has things such as this is a fast paced plot, this is a character focused, da da da. Maybe in that regard, David's saying, hey, it would be cool to have a book and see, the likability for characters or the quality of characters or this, just to have a tag of going, what are you getting into? A spice meter.
Sure.
So in that way, I could see, cool. But then how much do you get into the weeds and details before just everything's listed out on a book? That's one thing. But also when we're rating a book and we look at characters, our word that we use is irreplaceable. And we really thought through all of our categories here, and the reason we came up with that term for when we're judging characters, meaning our 5-star characters are irreplaceable characters, our 1-stars are incoherent characters. That's when we're judging. And each category we have these things we're looking for.
You're neutral, like dead center. Mm-hmm. You're 2.5.
You're 3 for us.
You're 3 for us. Is
irreplaceable.
Like, replaceable, but not incoherent. Like,
it makes sense.
Makes sense, but very replaceable. That's our 3, our neutral.
Yeah.
Which often can be, like, likability maybe is a factor one way or the other. But no, you should have that moment when you think, no other character could fit this role in this story. Comparing two characters, if you've read it, not spoiling anything, but for Sun Eater, you can't just take Darrow of Lycos and put him in Hadrian's place and you have the same story with different edges. Like, Hadrian Marlowe is a very unique character. He's not easily replaced, depending on the book. Empire of Silence, maybe a little bit replaceable, which is why it's not as good, but point still stands.
Yeah, and David's saying here, likability attachment versus the quality, while we use the term irreplaceable, is there are irreplaceable likable characters.
Mm-hmm.
Uncle Iroh.
Yeah.
He's such a well-made character that's extremely on the likable rating, extremely on the quality rating, but when we're looking at Uncle Iroh, he does both extremely well. It's not to say that a likable character isn't a 5-star, that obviously helps and you're rooting for them, but sometimes just likability and your attachment to that character can make them 5-stars because they're so likable, unlike any other book you've read and a character that you've read. So I think when we judge something or we judge a character, it's kind of entrenched into that rating a bit. Like, let's say there's a character you're following in Discworld and you're like, this is my favorite. They're hilarious. They're so likable. Boom, boom, boom. Maybe they even feel similar to some other characters, like somewhat, but you go, nobody's done it like this.
Yeah. Well, think about Piranesi. Yeah. I know one of the factors where we love characters so much is how likable they are. And in a very unique way of like, it's hard to replace Piranesi.
Yes.
Of any other type of character. He's a really unique character for this story, but he's also so incredibly likable.
Mm-hmm.
You just love following him.
Exactly.
So,
5-star character right there. I mean,
so, yeah.
Yeah.
Who was this person we disagree with again?
David.
David.
We know David.
Hot take. Disagreed.
Yes. Ranja has this take. Ranja has this take. The Lord of the Rings movies are better than the books. 3, 2, 1. Hard agree.
Disagree.
Agree. You are right, Ranja.
It's probably one of the things we disagree with the most on.
Yeah. Because we both are firm and...
I love the movies, but the books are better. That's a universal truth just across time and history. I fail to find another example. Like, when is the movie better than the book? It's not Lord of the Rings.
I'm sorry. Do we say a Lord of the Rings quote every episode, or do we play a Lord of the Rings song every episode?
Yeah. Is there an auditory companion to the books? No.
Yes, and Andy Serkis. He has some great lines. He sings Bombadil song, Tum Bombadillo. That's not in the beginning.
Movies are amazing. But
dun 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 dun.
I love
dun.
It. But the here's the biggest problem is after I read the books after the movies.
Same.
The fact that Frodo is done dirty in the movies. Dirty. Like, yes, bad. Frodo in the books, so much, a much more compelling character. The world building is significantly better in the books. The only thing the movies have going for is the action and the music. It's a great visual medium, but it's not better than the books. The books, the movies do a slightly worse imitation of the greatness of the books.
Mm.
It's the fact that the books are so amazing, the movies are so amazing, but still not better. Why would you say the movies are actually better than the books?
I watched the movies before I read the books, just like you. I think I watched these movies first when I was 3 or 4 years old, or realistically, I was probably six or seven, but you think you're younger when you're probably 6 or 7 years old when my dad showed me.
Probably two.
The Lord of the Rings movies are what got me into storytelling, fantasy, anything at a young age. I have the biggest nostalgia for Lord of the Rings because of it. To me, my introduction wasn't the books. I read that as I was older, and I appreciate and respect the hell out of them. And J.R.R. Tolkien, like he is the GOAT for a reason. However, the movies were able to get an emotional punch out of me. I don't have to defend how amazing the movies are. Everybody knows how amazing the movies are.
What does it do better than the books? I guess that's the key part.
Hey, the thing it does better is the emotion, the character journeys, and what you can't do in the book medium. The songs and every story beat in the film is so impressive and tear-jerking, whereas in the book, it's more like the book is an appreciative thing to look at and awe and admire. It's a thing to the books are a thing to admire. The movies are a thing to wrench you. Like reading the Lord of the Rings book, I never cried. Watching the films, every movie, multiple times, I cry. And because the visual medium can help with that, that's one thing. The character arcs and journeys in the books are good, but even I would still question some decisions of where, you know, cliffhangers you at the end of book two with this is light spoiler. It's Lord of the Rings. We can spoil Lord of the Rings.
You can spoil books. I can't.
I'm putting a disclaimer. There's a difference.
To spoil just a bad book that no one should read. You want to spoil Lord of the Rings.
You get 60 years. I'm also disclaimer. Okay.
Fine.
Disclaimer. Fine, but you know, I even think the movies, even though there's things that, no, it doesn't do a 1-to-1 for the book. I get like the third movie, Return of the King, Sam and Sam, Gollum, Frodo going up the mountain and the breadcrumbs, different, et cetera. There's choices that were made. But even with how the Lord of the Rings movies start and finish and are so confined, they packaged them better in the movies. I think Peter Jackson made the right decisions, and the books where it goes part one, part two, like you follow this set of characters, then this. The movie, because it's also more modern, so this is just a way point of view changes happen. Like we jump back and forth between Frodo and Sam, and then Aragorn, Legolas, Gimli, etc. Whereas in the book, I was going, you know, just one of their point of views for half the book, then the next half, kind of like just volumes of a book where it didn't interweave them, where I'm much more engaged with the movies, even appreciating the books, love the books, but movies for me packaged it better, emotional ride better. And on top of that, they take, here's the incredible things about the movies, that a great adaptation, we both agree with this, a great adaptation isn't just they did everything word for word and followed it truthfully. Very because true. The movie kept the soul of the story, that's undeniable. Both kept the soul, did not change the themes, and did not change the integral parts of the story and what Lord of the Rings is. But then on top of that, did things that you have to change in order to make it work in the medium. And for one, the impressive thing that just does not happen today is Peter Jackson and the writing team put in lines to that movie that sound like Tolkien. That Tolkien did not write, that we just attribute to Lord of the Rings and Tolkien. Like, a wizard is never late. He arrives precisely when he means to. Tolkien didn't write that. Some writer did in the writing room. That's how phenomenal this is. You bow to no one. Like, these are things we align with Lord of the Rings that did not happen in the book. And just also changed in a way. But again,
that part did happen in the book. Different context.
But changed integrally. So, I mean, it just changed order,
but yes.
Still, but you see the way it was changed and moved around made it such an emotional gut wrench. So that's why I think it's so damn impressive. I bow to you, Peter Jackson and J.R.R. Tolkien. And of course, no Peter without J.R.R. Tolkien. So I respect granddaddy J.R.R. Tolkien for giving us these books and these films that somehow did even better than the books.
I just gotta say, like, my experience on reading the books, because I didn't have high expectations for the books because I've read the, I've watched the movies so many times. I've seen the movies like at least more than 12 times, I think, like the entire trilogy. But when I read the books, there were a handful of moments that I forgot the movies. I was that sucked into the world where I forgot that Frodo lives. Frodo is like at a point, like, I forgot. How does it do that? How does he do that? He writes so well that I forgot the context. I forgot that I watched the movie. That's how sucked into it I was. The world building, to me, I have never been so emotionally and intellectually stimulated in world building than Lord of the Rings. I've told the story several times before at this point, but the Entwives was the thing that just got me so fascinated of like going, I was trying to piece things together from the world. I have never been that engaged in a story than with the book. There were emotional moments for characters that hit so much harder than basically anything in the movies. To me, the moment where Aragorn is leading the team down into the mountain to go get the ghost army. And again, I'm explaining it poorly, but in context, when Gimli gets to the front, he freezes. He can't go into the mountain. He's scared. And then he watches Aragorn go down into the cave and he realizes himself of like, I'm a dwarf, damn it. And I'm terrified. But this human, Aragorn's able to like walk in with no hesitation. Like, that's the type of leader I need to be. Like, he, following this man gives me strength and the courage to continue on. And this is a human and I'm a dwarf. Like, I should be the one leading us into this cave. I'm ashamed for how scared I am. Like, I loved that moment. And in the movies, it's a joke. A lot of, like, to me, like, Gimli is played as a joke a lot of times in the movies, and I think he's far more significant in the books. Point being, books are masterful. Also, the fact that it has the Scourging of the Shire. That is the perfect ending.
The extended edition of Return of the King has the Scourging of the Shire. Technically, it does.
Not really.
You remember Aragorn's holding the, help me out with the name.
Palantir?
Yeah, holding Palantir, and then sees a quick flash image of it. I don't remember seeing that as a kid.
That's not the same context.
No, it's not the same. No, I'm just saying it's like those neat fun facts. Like, I forgot about that when I rewatched the film. Like, oh, that's the Scourging. I didn't realize that. Actually, I'm trying to remember the Lord of the Rings fun fact the other day that I just heard.
When Aragorn screams out and he kicks a helmet, he actually broke his foot.
It's the one.
Every time. It's now... It's law.
No, there
every time it happens, you have to tell somebody.
You have to. There's a new one I found out the other day. You realize they changed a country's tourism, and the entire country of New Zealand is now just Middle Earth.
Yeah.
A significant portion of their GDP is because of Peter Jackson and the Lord of the Rings. Their locations in Weta Workshop and Hobbiton and the sets they designed. One in 10 New Zealanders. One in 10 New Zealanders, so some crazy number, worked on this film in some regard. It took a whole country, and they made this mammoth of a production with Christopher Lee, rest in peace, who actually saw or met Tolkien in real life, and the passion every actor had. It's a literal fellowship where 20 years later, 25, it's going to be soon enough, this was the movie of their life. This was their magnum opus, and it's just undeniably that it's a masterful book and an even more masterful movie series. It's just, it will never be done again there. And I would even, I would agree with you maybe if Lord of the Rings was my second favorite movie ever, but it's my first. I will always defend my GOAT movies. It's the world's GOAT. It's also, there's a lot of GOATs in New Zealand, you know, that's, or sheeps. I think it's sheeps. Yeah.
Point being, books are better. Even if I love the movies.
You know, just you know what? I compel you. Go look up Ride of the Rohirrim right now. Watch that scene and tell me I'm wrong.
Go read the book. Tell me I'm wrong.
He's asking you to commit 10, 20 hours of your life. I'm just asking 5 minutes.
Oh, I'm sorry. We're appealing to TikTok brain people? Yeah, you're right. Oh, I'm so sorry.
We're an hour and a half in. I think they're vets at this point. They're fine. Okay. Now, Rania, thank you for that, because I knew we'd disagree on that one, so at least we'd have a strong disagreement somewhere. Mm-hmm. All right, this next one is from, and we got two more, and then we'll go to the next one, okay?
All right.
This one's from Lucas the Third. Lucas the Third says, agree. Don't know if this is a hot take necessarily, but I despise when an author's name is as big as the book title in the cover of said book. My mom once came to me and asked what the book Brandon Sanderson on my shelf was about.
Agree.
Okay. His mom walked in, hey, what's the book Brandon Sanderson about? Like, thinking that's the title of the book. Agree.
However,
things falling off a little bit.
Yeah, I built mine better.
We'll switch next episode.
No, okay. We aren't.
Agree. Hard agree. I mean, must we elaborate?
The one exception, Stephen King, because his name is so big on the book that the titles are meaning like it. What is someone going to ask you? Like, oh, what is Pet Sematary about? No, they're going to get what's that Stephen King book about? It's just always relevant. You know what I mean? It somehow works.
He's an auteur.
And also, like, the title, whatever his book's about, almost doesn't matter. Because how do people recommend it? Oh, it's a Stephen King book.
Huh.
They don't say, like, oh, this is a great book on X. No, it's, this is a fantastic Stephen King book.
This is a Cormac McCarthy. Is he at that level?
Similar. Probably.
That's weird. Still, because it's like, fresh in my mind.
Why are you reading the book? Is it about the book or is it about the author?
I mean, most of the time it's because of the book.
Most of the time.
But so that's why exceptions.
Yeah.
But also, it just doesn't look as good.
That's true.
Titles are cooler and helps with the cover art. It's just shelf-wise, I would rather have smaller author titles.
Yes, but Stephen King has King in his name. And I like King being large print on a book.
Touche. Yeah, that's a good point.
Not French enough? Can't.
It's a reference to a Nora film.
I didn't watch that one.
Yeah.
Pretentious prick.
Okay. That covers it. We're done.
I thought we had one more.
Well, it was like a, it's two-parter. Like, it was like that, and then he also commented the Brandon Sanderson thing. That's
We're
all
done.
We got. We're done.
Now, let us know, do you agree or disagree with doing two-parters of these? Or are we just being, like, cheapskate hacks of, like, you know, lazy and giving you a two-parter when we could have just made it one video?
One three-hour, really chonker video.
Yeah.
But you just called them TikTok brains. We have to give them a break. Intermission.
Also,
part of this, too, is we realize that we sometimes put out a lot of content, especially when we're doing lives as well. We're getting comments now of, hey, I can't catch up. I can't keep up. If we did 3-hour episodes twice a week, we're all in trouble.
Yeah, we are.
We can't ask them to commit more time than that.
No, but they're now just thinking to themselves like, God damn it. Another week waiting on Kingdom of Death. That's what they're thinking. It's like, what's the next video? You know what next video is going to be? Mm. It's definitely not going to be Kingdom of Death. Now they know.
It's going to be part two to this video.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let us know if you liked or disliked the video. Using the
thumb.
Wow, we have visuals for once. We're going to start getting a prop pool. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
We'll see you next episode.
Let us know your hot takes down below.
Yes. Goodbye.
All right. Bye, all.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.